UN chief says Pakistan needs unprecedented assistance as the flood disaster there appears far from over.
Well, Ban Ki-moon says hundreds of millions of dollars is now needed to help the flood-hit areas.
This disaster is far from over. The rains are still falling and could continue for weeks. Dams are at severe risk of rupture. We want to help provide emergency health care to 14 million people with a special program for children and for pregnant women. To do this, we need more support from the international community. We have launched the appeal for $460 million for the most immediate needs for coming 90 days.
At a press conference with Pakistani President Asif Ali Zardari, Ban called on the international community to help flood victims. Ban visited Pakistan to assess the damage caused by 2 weeks of devastating floods in the country. Earlier, in a meeting with Prime Minister Yousuf Reza Gilani, Ban warned of a second wave of deaths unless flood victims receive humanitarian aid, clean water and medicine. The country has also been hit by a cholera outbreak. It's already killed one person and affected more than 36,000 others.
Well, NATO has acknowledged the killing of 5 Afghan civilians in the south of the country. The civilians were killed by a NATO airstrike carried out on Thursday in the Lashkargah district of Helmand province. The alliance says 3 people were killed and 4 others wounded when a NATO aircraft targeted a compound. 2 of the wounded later died. Rising civilian casualties have angered Afghans. A UN report released this month showed over 1,200 Afghans were killed in the first half of this year. A quarter of the deaths were blamed on foreign forces.
Well, the commander of the U.S. forces in Afghanistan has said he reserves the right to advise President Barack Obama against a troop pullout from the country in 2011. Well, General David Petraeus said Obama had told him he would seek the top commander's advice before making any decision to withdraw from Afghanistan. Obama has said some U.S. troops will return home from will return home from there in mid-2011. Petraeus's remarks come as U.S. public support for the Afghan mission and Obama's handling of the war hits an all-time low. This as the security situation keeps deteriorating, with U.S.-led forces killed by Taliban militants on a near daily basis across Afghanistan.
Well, the total death toll of the U.S.-led foreign troops in Afghanistan has passed the 2,000 mark since the onset of the war in 2001. The deaths of at least one more U.S. service member, an Australian and a Briton in the past 2 days have pushed the total fatalities to 2,002. Over 60% of those killed are Americans. The governments of the nations contributing troops to the war are facing increasing opposition at home to the Afghan mission. The war has already brought down a government in the Netherlands in February and a German president in May. Well, advocates for veterans say the U.S. military routinely dismissed thousands of soldiers for having a personality disorder at the height of the Iraq War.
Well, this is why they were more likely suffering from the trauma of war. Advocate groups say the troops misdiagnosed with personality disorder were discharged from the military, making them ineligible for health care and other benefits. The U.S. military regards post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD, a mental disability caused by acute stresses of war. But a personality disorder is considered a condition that predates military service. The symptoms of PTSD, which include anger, anxiety and depression, can easily be confused for the Army's description of a personality disorder. The Army has acknowledged the problem existed but says it has corrected the system.
The ongoing Israeli siege of the Gaza Strip has made life even more impossible for the people of the enclave. This amid fresh warnings by international organizations. Our correspondent has the details.
Years of tight Israeli and Egyptian blockade of Gaza have left scars in all aspects of life in the Strip. Filippo Grandi, the Commissioner General of the UN Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees in the Near East, UNRWA, said that the problems faced by the Gaza are not just humanitarian, but encompass every aspect of society. Mr. Grandi also expressed concern over UNRWA's precarious financial situation, saying that schools and clinics in Gaza would be closed if donors failed to provide help. The agency provides education, healthcare, social services, and emergency aid to some 4.7 million Palestine refugees living in Jordan, Lebanon, and Syria, as well as in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip.
In Gaza, where the situation is very critical, it will affect the refugees more than any place. We have a deficit of $84 million.
UNRWA is funded almost entirely by voluntary contributions from member states. It requires $600 million a year to carry out its work, including in the education sector, where UNRWA employs 20,000 teachers, but its funding falls 20% of the amount needed. Last March, nations gathered in the Egyptian Red Sea resort of Sharm el-Sheikh pledged nearly $5 billion to help rebuild Gaza. However, they have failed to deliver on their promises, and there has been little reconstruction as building materials are still not allowed in.
This is part of the, I think, the Zionist and American pressure in order to end to force the Palestinians to accept any resolutions and to accept to go to the direct negotiations.
During the Gaza war, thousands of homes and many public structures were either reduced to rubble or severely damaged. More than 1,400 people, most of them civilians, were also killed. And although Israel allows more consumer goods into the territory, many people are still suffering from poverty, unemployment, lack of medicine and medical equipment.
This will further weaken both the economic situation and the services provided by the UNRWA to Palestinian refugees. Those refugees who are entirely dependent on UNRWA's aid will face catastrophic and critical conditions given they lost all other sources of income.
Adding to the misery of siege, loss of shelter and total destruction of livelihood, Palestinian refugees will have to worry about the further deprivation and suffering that the future may hold for them. Akram Saeed Al-Satari, Press TV, Gaza.
Meanwhile, 11 Palestinian factions have held an extraordinary meeting in the Syrian capital, Damascus. They have unanimously rejected any direct talks between Israel and the Palestinian Authority.
Heads and representatives of 11 Palestinian factions held an extraordinary meeting in Damascus to come up with a unified stand concerning the Palestinian-Israeli direct negotiations. This time, the three Palestinian factions, the Popular Front for Liberating Palestine, the Democratic Front for Liberating Palestine, and the People's Party, that had not participated in such meetings for nearly 2 years and a half, were present. They released a statement which touched on a number of important issues affecting Palestinians and warned them against giving up their national aspirations.
We Palestinian factions declare that we reject Palestinian-Israeli negotiations, direct or indirect, because such negotiations aim to cover the Israeli practices in Judaizing Jerusalem codes, building settlements, and the Israeli siege on the Gaza Strip.
The statement also called for an immediate end to the current rift among Palestinian factions and urged them to do their best to achieve national unity. The factions emphasized the need to reconstruct the Palestinian Liberation Organization and its institutions, but said no group should consider negotiations with Israel as an option, as they have proved to be useless.
There are a number of elements that make this meeting important. It coincides with the Israeli Judaization of Jerusalem al-Quds and settlements building, in addition to the American pressures that are exerted to start direct negotiations.
Recently, the Arab League endorsed direct Palestinian peace talks with the Israelis, but has left the timing to the Palestinian Authority. But acting Palestinian Authority chief Mr. Abbas has demanded a settlement freeze and a return to 1967 borders as a precondition of direct talks. At the end of their meeting, the delegates reaffirmed that resistance was the only way to liberate the occupied lands. Palestinian factions say they are against the talks because, firstly, such negotiations threaten Palestinian rights, and secondly, for the last 2 decades, negotiations with Israel, whether direct or indirect, have not brought any results. Muhammad Ali, Press TV, Damascus.
Now, it's been 10 weeks and 3 sets of sanctions against Iran, one from the United Nations Security Council, for the first time not unanimous. But for those pushing for the UN round, the US and Europe, they weren't quite enough. They both imposed their own unilateral sanctions on Iran too. So how are they impacting Iran's energy sector? The press of his Nagis Mobalaghi looks at Iran's gas sector and how one big project in the south of the country is progressing.
Iran, the world's second largest oil exporter of OPEC and home to the world's second largest natural gas reserves. Most of that gas is here, South Pars, the world's largest gas field. Shared with Qatar, Iran's part of the field has reserves of about 14 trillion cubic meters. That's about 8% of the world's reserves. Iran's developing the South Pars gas field in 24 phases, 8 of which are fully operational. Officials say when complete, its revenue will soar to $100 billion a year. But what about now? Malaysia's SKS and China's Sinopec and CNPC are still involved. But big Western investors have frozen or withdrawn cooperation on the project. And with a new round of UN Security Council sanctions and unilateral EU and US measures too, will even more investors shy away?
In the latest round of sanctions, American companies put huge pressure on the US government and Congress, saying they're bearing the brunt and losing profit. The same is true of Western and Eastern firms. They have developed plants and employed workers for the South Pars gas field. They're not going to watch idly what sanctions are imposed. They will find their own ways to bypass the sanctions.
Iran is also about to start offering the first batch of domestic bonds to fund the project. Six stages by March 2011, raising $3 billion. That's alongside another $2 billion in euro bonds. So now, even your average Iranian can get involved in the country's gas sector.
Participation of all people in this gas, this is good. This is really, calling for help from everybody to participate and play its share in paving the way for mitigating the effect of the sanctions in the explorations of the future.
The United States says sanctions against Iran are not aimed at the public, that they are aimed only at pressuring the government to give up its nuclear energy ambitions. It's a claim vehemently rejected by Iranian MPs.
Paradoxically,
it's paradoxical, and not in the interest of the US. They're trying to separate the people from their government. How is it possible that putting pressure on Iran's economy hurts just the government and not the people? Even though, thank God, our economy is in a condition that the sanctions won't harm the government nor the nation.
But with big companies pulling out their investment in their technology, can there really be no impact on projects like the South Pars gas field?
Iran says that sanctions may at times slow them down, but that they won't stop the country's progress. Some Western investors and energy giants, though, have withdrawn cooperation from the South Pars gas field. But that hasn't stopped the project. And if Iranians invest in South Pars, then it will become a national project, literally backed by the Iranian people and the government together. It may then be harder to argue that sanctions against Iran are aimed at one and not the other. Nagis Mobalaghi, Press TV, Tehran.
Well, the smog from the forest wildfires has returned to the Russian capital, Moscow.
Experts say the level of carbon emissions were nearly six times higher than usual days.
During the day, the concentration of indicators of smoke pollution will exceed the regular levels in the capital. In particular, the level of hydrocarbon emissions, the substances that give the air this unpleasant smell, were 5.5 times higher than the usual Moscow level this morning.
He said the smog is very dangerous to human health and can harm cardiovascular system in the future. However, the expert added that the winds will partly clear Moscow skies by Monday. Emergency officials said there were 16 wildfires outside the capital on Sunday, but authorities have reassured the fires close to Sarov nuclear facilities have been put out to a large extent. On Saturday, the head of Russia's nuclear agency, Sergei Kirienko, had warned blazes could soon reach the Sarov site.
Turkish authorities have detained an American journalist over his alleged links to the Kurdistan Workers' Party or the PKK militants. Jake Hess has been detained on suspicion of aiding the PKK militants. His lawyer says Hess will be probably deported to the U.S. He's accused of collaborating with the Union of Kurdistan Communities, which is allegedly an offshoot of the PKK. Turkey and much of the international community consider the PKK a terrorist group.
Well, every year, thousands of people in Iran visit one of the biggest cultural events held during the holy month of Ramadan in the capital, Tehran. The one-month venue showcases books, artwork, and numerous workshops related to the Muslims' holy book, the Quran. Press TV's Amir Mehdi Kazemi has this report.
This is Tehran's Imam Khomeini prayer venue, the largest prayer ground in Iran. The huge mosque is home to many international cultural and religious events in Iran, such as Tehran's International Book Fair and currently the 18th International Quran Exhibition. The exhibition covers a vast area of 90,000 square meters. Its aim is to create an opportunity for visitors to get more familiar with the aspects of the Quran.
Every year I come here with my family. That is a good cultural event. Here we feel closer to the Quran, plus that we get the chance to find the latest books published in this regard.
Here we can learn more about Islam. For those young people who are looking for answers related to their faith, I think this is the place to be.
It is the longest annual exhibition in Iran in terms of duration. The venue hosts over 350 Iranian and foreign publishers active in the field of Islamic books and the latest print versions of the Holy Quran.
It is the biggest Quranic event, which takes place in Tehran every year during the month of Ramadan. Every day, thousands of people who are seeking to have a better understanding of Islam and Quran visit this exhibition. It seems that this year's venue is more focused on target groups.
Attracting art lovers, large galleries showcase various forms of traditional and modern works of art, all inspired by the Quran. The exhibition has been designed to respond to the needs of people with different tastes. Ancient manuscripts and versions of the Holy Book, some dating back to 14 centuries ago, are on display for the public. There are also special programs and competitions for children aimed at making them familiar with the principles of Islam.
When it comes to religious upbringing, sometimes children are overlooked. That's why we try to attract them by posing questions on religion and encouraging them to learn more about Islam. We want to help the children understand the meaning of the Holy Book in simple words.
Quran, Book of Life, is the motto of this year's event in Tehran. The International Quran Exhibition is the main cultural event in the capital during Ramadan and is open until September 3rd. Amir Mehdi Kazemi, Press TV, Tehran.